Hi, I'm Leon Gorin, president of PEO Leadership, a peer-to-peer leadership advisory firm. We're an amazing community of CEOs, presidents, and senior executives. Ask yourself, are you learning as fast as the world is changing? It's time for Ontario business leaders to band together for counsel and support. It's time for you to tap into the business wisdom of our peer groups and unlock new ways to grow. I want you to come out of this COVID crisis a better leader and your organization ready for what's next. Take the first step at peo-leadership.com. What you're going to experience this morning is one of our many PEO community events where we invite various thought leaders from around the world to join us to discuss some opportunities and challenges our members are facing. These community events represent one leg of a three-legged stool in our promise to help leaders realize their goals and objectives for themselves and their organizations. The other two legs are a little bit more intimate in terms of their fewer numbers. But the first leg really is about defining success for every leader that participates in our community. And that's not just about the business. It includes both their health, family, career, and today's session really about their wealth. And sort of defining what success looks like, understanding where they are today, and our job is really to enable them and try and get them from A to point B and keep them focused in a straight line. And then the second leg in sort of delivering our promise is putting these members into advisory boards, facilitated by that same executive advisor who works on the roadmap with those individuals and ensuring that the door is closed in those advisory boards and the conversation is both meaningful, challenging, and really objective so you can really get to the meat of some of these issues and opportunities these leaders are facing. We all understand that leadership can be extremely lonely, especially in a rapidly changing business landscape where you need to be agile and decisive. If you're operating on your own, you're really operating at a disadvantage. And to be successful in today's world, it's all about pushing your leadership capabilities, your learnings, and constant working to build up the right connections. At PEO Leadership, our members include some of Canada's strongest leaders among representing almost every industry. They lead both Canadian SMEs and large multinational organizations. And we have some of the world's best executive advisors working with them. And of course, I think we have some of the best connections in the world. Our leaders understand the value and importance of being able to connect and think with each other as they work to successfully achieve those personal goals and those of their organization. After today's session, take a moment. If you're interested, you can reach out to me or you can just visit our site at www.peo-leadership.com. So we're about to get our session underway here. And I just want to go through some of the logistics here. I'm getting a couple of audio fine here. Okay, I'm just noticing as I'm talking logistics, whether people can hear me, but I think people can hear me. Thane, you can hear me?
Yes.
Okay, good. I'm just watching the chat side. Yeah. So what we're going to do, Thane and I are going to kick off this fireside chat here for about 20 to 25 minutes. I've got a number of questions for him. And then I'm going to open it up for Q&A for the rest of the group here. And you're all on mute right now, but as you post your questions in the group chat, what we'll do is we'll keep an eye on them. And I may call on you by telling you to come off mute and to sort of pull, to ask Thane directly the question. So I think we're ready to go. Our guest today, which I just called him out, is Thane Stenner. I've known Thane for many years. He's a fellow Canadian. He was born and raised in Vancouver. And now he's based in downtown San Francisco. He's the managing director of Stenner Zoni Group of Greystone Consulting of Morgan Stanley. I think Morgan Stanley released results, by the way, in the last 2 days. We can talk about that too, Thane. Their group manages $20 billion U.S. in assets and has been ranked number one in California based on Barron's Top 50 Advisor list in 2020. His clients tend to have a net worth between $50 million and $6 billion. And of course, Thane is chairman emeritus of Tiger 21 as he started the organization just, I think it was about 10 years ago here. He's been in the market advising clients for over 33 years, and his father was also in the investment business. And what's really fascinating is Sir John Templeton was one of his many mentors in his early teens. So Thane, thank you for joining us today. It's awesome to have you here.
Absolute pleasure to join. Thank you.
So, you know, we sort of went out with the topic about this whole dislocation around the market and the economy. And it's really a lot that we've been seeing within our own members, right? We're watching these businesses go and it's giving us a sense of the economy. And then we're watching these markets go up, up and away. There's nothing stopping these things. So I thought we'd even just start by laying some foundation. And I broke it into two parts, you know, giving us a sense of what your perspective is on the economy, and then give us the foundation of a little bit on the market as well. So Thane?
Okay. Well, thank you once again. And I tend to, when I present it, I tend to do things in pretty rapid fire format. So hopefully that'll work for everybody. So first 6 months of the year basically has been extremely challenging, as we all know. And in fact, Q2 showed, according to the Atlanta Fed, to be down almost 50% on an annualized basis in GDP. So we had not seen numbers like that until the Great Depression back in the 1930s. So the understatement, I would say, is that things have been very challenging, obviously caused by COVID. As far as the economic numbers that we're seeing now, you've heard lots of different commentary around, you know, is this a B or a W or a U or an L? And Leon and I were sharing this prior to starting. The latest I've heard, is the leaning Y to the right, where the top part of the Y is the stock market, kind of rapidly rising like it has since the lows in March, and the low prong, which was in essence currently still the economy. So what we've just gone through, in essence, has been the fastest bear market in history. It was down in Toronto around 37% from peak to low. And the U.S. market was down roughly 35% during that period. And then we've seen the fastest recovery, roughly up over 44% in both cases. So to say things have been volatile would be a massive understatement. So that's kind of what I'd begin with.
No, thank you, Thane. It's interesting. I'm going to jump right into it. I mean, in terms of seeing something like this before, historically, do we have anything to compare this to?
Not really, because the great, you know, if you go back to, you know, the terrorist attacks, for example, in 2001, you know, that was a sudden event in a regional area that affected, but normalcy came back, you know, fairly quickly over a 6 month time frame. The Great Recession that occurred from, you know, 2008 to 2010 occurred, but it was also caused by, you know, an overleveraged banking or mortgage system. In this situation, all economies everywhere have been affected by this COVID situation. So, in my career of 33 years, I've not seen anything even close to this from a perspective of the impact on everything and all at once. No, I don't think we've seen anything like this before.
So when you think about, and I'm coming back, you know, the market popping back so quickly, the other thing that's kind of new is the amount of fiscal and monetary policy here that all the governments have just been pumping money into the system here. I mean, how much does that play into it? Could that make it sustainable? And there really isn't a dislocation. There's a dislocation, but it's not really a dislocation.
Yeah. So, you know, as a reminder, obviously the stock markets and the fixed income markets for that matter are leading indicators. They tend to move in advance of the underlying economy. And that started to take place on February 19th was the peak and the low was March 23rd. So prior to the recessionary numbers confirming that, you know, the markets had already declined, you know, over a third prior to us, you know, seeing the economic data come out here and confirmed over the last few months. So the markets, in my opinion, you know, because of the flood of cash printed by central banks around the world, I think have created another bubble, basically, in the equity markets. And for that matter, likely the fixed income markets based upon where the yields are today. So, you know, in context, the U.S., and I'm based here in San Francisco, the U.S. has printed, in essence, the equivalent on the currency of an extra 25% in the course of the last 3 to 4 months. So that's rushed into the equity markets. The Fed is buying corporate bonds, which is trying to stabilize the system. And, you know, in fact, at some point, they may even, if they need to, buy equities like Japan has in previous circumstances. So personally and professionally, I guess my comment would be that I do believe that the equity markets have gotten ahead of themselves currently, based upon what we're seeing currently in the underlying economy and the stats we're seeing, even literally in the last few weeks. I could talk more about that in a bit.
Yeah. So when you say ahead of, you know, ahead of itself, how far ahead of itself do you think this is?
Well, yes. Great question. Great question. So historically, the equity markets are a leading indicator by anywhere from 6 to 12 months. So how can I quantify that? A lot of analysts and a lot of strategists are commenting now at they're justifying existing equity prices based upon going out all the way out to 2022 earnings, which is fascinating because, you know, roughly half the companies have deferred, you know, guidance on their earnings over the course of the next 12 months. So trying to, you know, digest or prognosticate based upon something that's 2 to 3 years out is quite fascinating. Normally the equity markets are looking out 6 to 12 months and are a discounting mechanism towards that. So this is one of the reasons why I think a lot of the good news of the potential recovery has already been baked into prices.
And what do you think about, there's talk about, you know, a few companies sort of driving the markets here, right? So especially the technology and the disruptive innovation. And when you look at some of them, be it the Teslas or, you know, the Amazon, get it. They're going to be here. They're going to be mammoths in the future. But they are certainly, is it true that a lot of those are driving the actual market, the S&P and the Dow and the NASDAQ to these heights? And there are a lot of companies out there that are really not moving at the same pace.
So just to give you some stats, it's a great point. You've got, in essence, the heavy lifting of the equity markets right now by, you know, the top 5 to 10 tech companies. And we all know what they are, the FAMEs or FANGs, it depends on, you know, how you want to call it, the Facebook, Alphabet, Amazon, Apple, Microsoft are the heavy lifters today. So just to give you some stats, year to date, the underlying tech composite, basically those names are up roughly 35% or so year to date. And the underlying S&P is basically slightly negative. So what that really means is the other 495 names in the S&P 500 are still in negative territory year to date. So that's how much of a bifurcated market it is. The last time this occurred was in the dot-com period, and the top five names then made up roughly 16 to 17% of the S&P 500 market cap. Today, the top five names make up roughly 25% of the S&P 500. So five names lifting basically the full market. So historically, if you look back through the last 100 years, whenever you've got a high degree of concentration of just a few companies really driving the market, that tends to be a period of time in which you want to be much more defensive and a lot more cautious with equity allocations.
So I hear what you're saying. But I mean, we were talking about that a year ago as well, right? We were always talking about these tech companies are flying and they've continued to fly through this period. And if you weren't in them, you really got hurt badly. And so, you know, you sit here today and you go, can you afford not to be in the Apples, the Amazons and the Teslas today? Because there's some people, like Kathy Woods, you take Tesla, her best bet is 15,000 US by 2024. So,
yeah. So there's no doubt that COVID has brought forward and accelerated everything online communications wise. There's no doubt about it. But I'm also reminded by, you know, some quotes of, you know, John Templeton or Warren Buffett, where they talk about you can have a great company, you can buy a great company, but you can also overpay for that company. So the price earnings multiples and the price per sales multiples of the tech companies, they are baking in a lot of good news. I mean, you know, just some of these, you know, Zoom, for example, we're on Zoom today. Fortunately made a little bit of money on Zoom here this last year, but you know, Zoom is trading like over 100 times revenues currently, just to give you some context around that. So you can have these great companies like Apple, but the price that you pay for them does matter over a period of time. So, you know, interestingly, even, you know, Warren Buffett on Berkshire, on their public equity allocations today, Apple has soared and currently makes up 25% of Berkshire's public portion of their portfolio. A lot of people don't know this, but they've got about 90 businesses within Berkshire, of which roughly 50 are publicly traded. So out of the public portion, Apple has zoomed ahead, pun intended. So I think, you know, again, price paid matters over time. And if you're a mid to long-term investor, you can end up owning a great company, but if you overpay for it, you can end up with disappointing results over time.
So we know, even in our audience, that a lot of people are holding a lot of cash, and a lot of the smart investors. It's actually one of the reasons I wanted to have this conversation with you, because I'm worried, like all our leaders, they work so hard building value in their business for years. The executives are putting money in their RSPs, they're saving their money. And now we're in a situation where you take Apple, for example, it's unbelievable the rise in Apple, right? Buffett's sitting, he's not really buying stuff. Does Buffett sell Apple right now because he thinks it's overvalued? Like, and this probably relates to our those in the room here as well. Like, do we start selling stuff or do we not really care? Like, it should be just a long-term hold and leave it alone.
So first of all, I would consider myself a long-term optimist. And I keep reminding myself of that today, because at times of more speculative periods, like what I believe today is, you have to remind yourself that, you know, even though there may be some pain coming on the equity markets, you know, be ready to try to take advantage of that. So when it comes to cash, for example, what people say versus what people do, there's a big difference. So Warren Buffett does not consider himself to be a market timer per se. A lot of people have challenged him by saying he missed the boat on the March lows and didn't really deploy. In fact, he was a net seller during that period. He ended up selling out of a lot of the airline companies as one example. But you know, I've been a Berkshire shareholder for about 30 years myself. I've, you know, studied his annual reports going back the last, you know, 55, 56 years since he's a publicly traded company. And currently right now, he is around 30% cash. So he says he's not a market timer, but I've studied his cash positions over time. This is, number one, by far his highest ever period in percentage, not just dollar, but percentage-wise of the enterprise value of Berkshire Hathaway that he's ever been. The previous high that he ever got to was roughly 19% cash, and that happened to be in 2007, prior to the last recession. So somehow he seems to have a knack of being cashed up, or significantly cashed up before accidents happen. So currently he's over 30% cash. He just did announce the $9.7 billion acquisition in the midstream energy space here in the last 2 weeks. And I would say that there is some good value in the commodities area still, but he seems to not be in a rush to deploy capital. And when he was challenged at his streamed Berkshire AGM back a few months ago, he was challenged by saying, well, how come you didn't pounce on things when the markets were down 33%? His simple answer was early days. So really what he's saying, my takeaway from reading and how he communicates is the fact that he thinks we're going to be in for a more prolonged, challenging recovery period. So he's doing, you know, what he feels is best, and that is keeping a lot of cash on the sidelines. And at some point, I think he'll be extremely opportunistic and step into things. But so cash amongst your members, I think, is wise. The regrettable thing, though, is, you know, this is probably one of the most challenging, in fact, I would say it is the most challenging period of time in my career to be deploying capital. Interest rates are basically almost zero. I mean, for all intents and purposes, in the U.S., the Treasury rate is 0.121% this week. The 10-year bond yield was 0.641%. So, I mean, for the fixed income investor or for the investor that's looking to try to park money even on an after-tax, after-inflation basis, you're actually getting a negative rate of return right now. So to those people, I would be suggesting the following. With cash, I'd be applying as much as possible towards debt. Because one of the things we haven't talked about is the amount of, you know, debt in the system. And this is an area where we have a lot of concerns currently. But in essence, if you can reduce the debt on your personal balance sheet as well as your corporate balance sheet, to me, that's actually a good thing to do at this point of the overall market cycle. So I'll stop
that's
there.
Interesting, because you got like Bank of Canada last week comes on, he goes, we're holding at 0.25 and don't expect us to increase it. And so you're running a business and you sit there and go, that is nothing. Like that's zero essentially, right?
Yep.
Why wouldn't I borrow money now at no cost and really start to invest in the business? And
so yes, if you're borrowing now, and I would say borrowing as long out as possible. What I'm seeing with significant business owners is that's exactly what they're doing. But what I'm trying to, you know, stress here is if your personal balance sheet is a bit stretched, I'd be trying to, you know, shore that up as much as possible, just to make sure you're in a strong position personally. Because one of the things entrepreneurs always know is if your personal household scenario isn't as strong, it puts a lot of pressure on you and your business. So I guess maybe I should have differentiated that a little bit more and said, you know, from a perspective of your personal balance sheet, just trying to make sure you're, you know, you're not as levered as your business may be.
So let's push on with the debt conversation, because it leads to, you know, conversation deflation versus inflation. You know, in terms of what are we, when you put that much money into the markets that the feds are doing today, actually every government's doing, at some point in time, you think it's going to drive some type of inflation. We don't feel that right now. In terms of, at least we're not measuring it. Maybe we're measuring inflation incorrectly. I don't know, but we're not necessarily feeling. What are you seeing, or what do you think?
Yeah, so this is a big debate that's going on, even within Morgan Stanley. I mean, the Global Investment Committee is debating this every week as to what's showing up. So interestingly, for the first time in a long time, Morgan Stanley is actually suggesting an allocation of commodities, which they began about 6 weeks ago. That was the first time that they actually really, you know, suggested a meaningful position. And that was around, you know, they also have tips and some other commodity or inflation-related things. But basically what they're saying is next 12 months, economically, for the most part, is still in a deflationary cycle. And then heading into, you know, mid-2021 and beyond, we do think that inflation is actually going to start to rear its head during that period of time. So, you know, lots of debate around deflation, stagflation, inflation. You know, I don't know, I was on a BlackRock call last week, for example, and one of the markets that just was released in the last week, meat for restaurants, for example, has spiked over 40% in price in the last 6 weeks. So, you know, there's different areas of inflation that are starting to show up, but, you know, for the broader sense, you've got oil, you know, which has historically made up gas, made up a pretty significant portion of CPI, has rallied. We think it's probably overdone and will probably settle back down a little bit here. But I think at some point, with the amount of funds that have been printed to support the global system, inflation will be an issue. And I just think it's a bit early, but I do think it is coming. And, you know, it's probably through a valley here over the course of the next 12 months.
Well, it's interesting because I was on a call with you when they did the Tiger 21 summit. They had four speakers, right? Very well-known speakers. Yep. You interviewed one of them.
Yes.
And I'll even add David Rosenberg. I've been reading his stuff. But three out of the four speakers there said, I hate gold, but yet I'm buying gold right now. And what's that about it? I mean, what are they doing here?
Basically the market. So, you know, we've fortunately participated in gold and gold miners for the last 18 months. They're kind of more deep value and contrarian thinking the way we do things. Gold and gold miners 18 months ago were dogs. They had come down from the 2000 peaks. They were down 80% on the gold miner side. So it was an area that a contrarian deep value stream from the point of view of trying to step into it. So gold basically reflects a viewpoint of whether or not currencies are being debased. So with all, and I said earlier, with all the money being printed, I mean, literally the US dollar has increased roughly 25% of its inventory of dollars globally has been printed in the last 4 months. So that is inflationary. And so gold is starting to reflect that. There's serious concerns that, you know, at some point inflation will maybe take off and get away from the central bankers. A lot of people feel like, you know, the central bankers globally can control fully the markets and in essence manipulate the markets. That's true for a period of time, but not all the time. And if you look back through history of different bear markets in the equity markets, for example, it's been proven that they've helped at certain points, but then at some point the morphine wears off and the markets adjust. So I think in the case of gold, we have an allocation in gold. Right now it's around 7%. And we've participated in gold miners. Gold miners, though, just for those on the call here, gold mining stocks, this might surprise some of you, but from the March 13th bottom in gold miners, not the March 23rd bottom, March 13th, gold miners have rallied over 130%. So I would not be chasing it, just to be really clear. I would not be a buyer today of gold mining stocks today. But at some point, if they were to correct, 20 to 30% down from here, I'd be definitely, having a portion of the portfolio in gold mining stocks. But as far as gold, the commodity, historically, it's been, a 2000 year kind of hedge to a portfolio. So I think it's wise to have some gold in one's portfolio today.
Okay, no, that's great. So we talked about a little bit of the public markets, a little bit of commodities. I mean, when people look at their assets, need to look at the whole thing, right? Real estate, alternative investments, public markets typically could be 20% of your entire holdings. What do you think about the other assets? I mean, when you talk to your clients, you look at all types of alternative assets, real estate, private equity. Are they all high these days too, just like the public markets? Are we going to have a reckoning there a little bit?
Well, yeah. So, for example, the bond market is roughly seven times larger than the equity markets globally. So the bond market, here's where the real challenge is public companies have gone on a, binge this year, record year from the point of view of raising capital in the fixed income markets to kind of survive the COVID situation. governments have gone on a binge. And I would say, you know, COVID and a lot of the programs, the government programs, have deferred the issues and the balance sheet issues and debt issues on personal balance sheets. So, on the fixed income side, I'd say that the projected and the forecast the rates return on the fixed income are abysmal. Actually, if you look out over the next 5 to 10 years from where we are today, you know, the capital market assumption forecast that Morgan Stanley does, GMO, BlackRock, for example, all in the last quarter are projecting out returns that are less than half of what the returns have been over the course of the last 10 years. And when it comes to fixed income, they're actually forecasting a slightly negative return on the fixed income the next 5 years. So very challenging period to be trying to find balance, you know, in your portfolio. So this is one of the reasons why, as I said earlier, having a higher cash position, at least you don't have principal risk. You have inflation risk, but you don't have principal risk so much as you might have on the fixed income markets. So when it comes to alternative investments, you know, this is an area that we spend a lot of time and allocate a lot of capital to. There's a lot of different alternative strategies out there that can give you the opportunity set to do better than, you know, a lot of the public markets and a lot of the, you know, public equity and public fixed income markets going forward. So credit structures, long short structures, managed futures, and you know, a lot of other things. So alternatives, for those on the call that are not as familiar with what that means, alternatives really at the end of the day means anything that's not stocks, bonds, or cash. So whether it's real estate or commodities or, you know, other investment holdings. So I would say that, you know, when it comes to the opportunity set, there are opportunities for sure. We're finding some today, but I'm telling you, it's you have to do a lot more homework, and you have to kind of scour through a lot more things that aren't necessarily, some of the common things that you may have invested in the last decade. So alternatives do offer, in my opinion, a good area to be looking at, but you give up typically liquidity for a lot of those. Aside from real estate, obviously real estate can be a more liquid asset over time, but not like liquidity from the point of view of public markets.
I don't even want to go there, because if I open the can of worms on real estate here in Toronto, you're going to just make everybody feel very sad. And it's a Friday. Yeah. We're going into a weekend.
Yeah. So I remind everybody I'm a long-term optimist. but I do find myself today as I'm speaking with you, but also in general, finding myself in a place where, The next two years, in my opinion, is going to be a very slow, muted growth recovery. I was just listening to CNBC before I got on here, and some of the announcers and some of the commentators there were commenting. It's a good word. I think this green shoots that we're starting to see a little bit of here. You've got to remember that the stats are showing off an extreme low period. Like, we've literally seen the global economies tail off. And then what you've got is you've got a few other things to worry about. You've got a U.S. Election coming up. You've got a trade war continuing, or a Cold War developing between the U.S. and China. These are not good things. Politics aside, as far as, two major trading partners in the world fighting and bickering as they are, this is going to cause some problems for us over time. So yes, it is a Friday afternoon now. We're close to it. And I'm trying to remain, as a long-term optimist, but bottom line is everything we're reading, all the research we're reading from different sources, all the different business people we're talking to on our analyst conference calls and whatnot, are basically saying, they've got very little visibility in the next 12 months. The COVID situation, clearly is on the front burner. And everything that I'm hearing and seeing and reading is, yes, there's some optimism around potential vaccines and trials and tests by the end of the year or early next year. But the reality is, if you talk to most people, most of the Tiger groups or different clients we talk to, half of them say they wouldn't even take the vaccine if there was one, because they want to see if it, you know, has any serious side effects. So, you know, I find it very difficult to think that we're going to get back to normal, whatever that new normal looks like, for at least, you know, 18 to 24 months. So I wish I was more optimistic than that. But I also think that it's important to be a realist in this part.
That's great. Thank you. Before we head into the Q&A portion of this webcast, first, a brief note about PEO leadership from one of our members.
What I love about PEO leadership right now is how well our members are supporting each other and rising to face the COVID-19 challenge.
Paul Zadorsky, Senior Vice President, Crayola International.
Business is all about being able to rapidly adapt to change, but how do you learn as fast as the world changes?
PEO leadership lets you tap into the collective wisdom of some of Canada's top executives.
Having that peer group and broader leadership community to lean on, it makes all the difference.
The time to step up and lead is now. Go to peo-leadership.com.
I want to open it up to questions. So if you guys can put out your questions into the group chat, some of you have put it out in the survey, but even if you can put it up again, and as you are writing, they're flooding in. John Kustik, I'm going to get you to come off first off mute here. And John is part of Focus Asset Management. He's also an educational partner of PEO Leadership. And some of you have heard him speak before. We've had them in the early days of COVID. But John, have you heard anything from Thane that surprises you or that you guys are looking at differently?
To be honest, I would say no. I mean, I don't know Thane personally, but I find, I've read a lot of his articles over the years. His thought process is very much aligned with how we think about things. And so in general, I would say, I really agree with the outlook. Let's face it, we've had massive, liquidity-led market rebounds. And, given the, yes, it was a mandated economic shutdown, and obviously we have to reopen over time and we'll slowly recover the economy. But given all this backdrop, I think it warrants sort of patience and caution as we move forward. And in general, I would say, the themes that Thane touched upon, I think very much make sense for, the people listening to the call today.
That's great. Thank you, John. That's good. Andrew Nickel, you want to come off mute? And I know you got a question for us.
Sure. Again, the question that I just posted in chat had to do with Q2 results, which we know are coming out this week. And certainly more so next week, and then should trickle through over the course of a month. But I guess general expectation would be for fundamental results coming out showing the revenue loss over the past quarter. My question then is, why have we not seen the market starting to price this in now, given the expectation of these losses coming out? What's propping it up?
So I'll take that, if that's okay. So one example, Morgan Stanley in the last 48 hours came out with record quarterly results, and they beat expectations. But you have to realize that the expectations set have been, much lower. So it's easy to beat a target if the expected target has been reset considerably lower. So, yesterday the stock was up, a little bit. So I guess what I would say is the markets have been expecting a recovery off a very low point. The earnings releases this week have been, for the most part, ahead of expectations. But what I'm surmising here is that some of the smart money, some of the institutional money is actually selling into that strength at this point. So you've already had a 40% plus move upwards in the equity markets from the low. So clearly a lot of the investors that got in during that period of time are starting to take some profit right now. So I think, you know, I know it can be a confusing thing, but, you know, at the end of the day, you know, what do they say? Try to buy when things are very unclear and try to sell when you get more clarity. So, you know, I think what you're going to see is you're going to see some profit taking here into a quote unquote stronger than expected earnings season. So that's one of the reasons why the stocks, I think, will be a little bit more muted here. You also have seasonality in equity markets from here till October. So Q3 tends to be the weakest quarter historically. If you look back over the last 100 years, it tends to be, you know, people are off on holidays. There's less liquidity in the system. There's less trading activity in general by a lot of trading desks. So I think that may also be part of it, where people are just going to be reducing the risk positions into some strength of quarterly results. That's how I'd answer that.
Thanks. Just a follow-on to that, if you guys don't mind, just tying in, you know, one of the Warren Buffett measures, which is productive capacity or GDP to market cap. It seems like that has been at its most divergent we've ever seen.
Yes. So I did a presentation 2 days ago, and I used that graphic and that ratio in that presentation. So back in the dot-com period, year 2000, 2003, the market cap as a percentage of the gross national product of the U.S. economy, that's his favorite ratio that he's been quoted many times. Is if you had to only look at one, that's his favorite one. And back in the dot-com period, it approached 200%. It was around 192%, I think, was to speak. Today, as we, it's down. 5 weeks ago, that ratio was over 200%. So basically, it was around 210%. And as of today, it would be likely around 220% if we just fast-forwarded from early June. So we are in nosebleed territories and valuations. There's just simply no other way of putting it. And, you know, if Buffett's indicator, which he states is a, you know, more of a current valuations indicator versus a market timing indicator, just know where you are at in the market cycle. And that indicator would clearly demonstrate that we are at valuations that are in nosebleed territories. And a big part of that has been because of the technique we mentioned earlier. Now, there's also an analog graph used a couple days ago, which, Leon, you can circulate, because I've sent you the presentation deck a few days ago. But in there, what that same ratio does as a long-term 10-year forecasting ratio is projecting basically a negative 6% rate of return out of the U.S. equity market going into the next decade. That's sobering. So, things don't go in a straight line. They never do. But that is, coming back to my earlier comment, you can have great companies, but if you overpay for them, you can have a very disappointing outcome from the perspective of the investor's shoes.
Thank you.
Thank you, Andrew.
Great question.
I have another question here, and it was funny because I was going to ask you this as well. They asked me to ask you. It's around the election coming up, and two things. One was talk in the U.S., Biden winning the election and the impact on the market. But what wasn't also asked in this question is, how important is Biden's selection for VP? And will that have an immediate impact on the market as well?
Great questions, Ed. It's going to start to come in more and more into focus here over the next 60 days as we start to approach the November election. There's a site called PredictIt, which is kind of like a gaming prediction site, obviously. And they're showing right now a 20% spread on Biden winning as the president who knows, I'm sure that'll tighten as the results come in November, but for the most part, this is particularly challenging because you've got the presidential race, you've got the House and the Congress, and how it'll shift. In our viewpoint, there's definitely going to be a stronger shift towards Democrats across the board. And that's, Biden's already outlined some of his stimulus packages and renewable energy, for example, been one theme that he's just rolled out here in the last week, that he'd set up a $2 trillion package towards that. But he'd also increase corporate tax rates and likely some additional taxes on the wealthy. So, I mean, I'm living here in the U.S. I've spent about 7 years of my life in the U.S., 3 for career-wise and 4 for university. And, it shocks me, candidly, that, the two leading candidates for president for this next go, the U.S. couldn't have, a better set of options. And I'm saying that as a fellow Canadian. It's sad to kind of see. I've met Joe Biden before, more like about 10 years ago. He was sharper, very thoughtful. If I could vote, I'm on a working visa right now, if I could vote, I think I would vote for him. But clearly there's some concerns around his mental acuity. So, Leon, your question around who his VP is going to be, I think the markets are going to react to that. And I think we're going to find that out here in the next 6 days as to how people view it. Because, quite candidly, whoever's picked as VP could very well be an acting president in the United States, the largest, most important country in the world. So, it's going to be interesting is all I can really comment about that.
Another trigger point, potentially.
Yeah.
Michael Kalpin, you want to come off? You got a question here about inflation. I know we sort of touched on it, but maybe you want to elaborate a little bit more. Do I still have you on here? Okay, maybe no. I'll just read his question then. It comes back to inflation, if it's going to bite us due to government stimulus driving increases in money supply. And we talked about effective hedges. We talked gold quickly, but is real estate one? And then somebody else actually asked, Tony asked the question is the equity market seem the most effective inflation hedge today?
Well, that's a multi-layered question. And I'll let John maybe take a swing at that as well after I'm done with it. real assets, hard assets, such as real estate long-term has been a very good inflation hedge over time. I guess my concern about wholeheartedly suggesting at this point is, what type of real estate? There's many different types. And I would say that during one graph in my presentation, talk about, data centers, for example, have been up during this whole COVID situation. Obviously, retail malls, shopping centers, things like that have been hit really hard during this period of time. So, it really depends on the type of real estate, I guess, would be the simplest answer to that. Things like TIPS, which are inflation, treasury participation, trading units, would be something that could assist you. Commodities, historically, have been a very good inflation hedge. Commodities today, as a broader set, it started to rally here in the last 3 months, but basically up until 3 months ago, commodities were the cheapest that they've ever been vis-a-vis the stock market in the last 50 years. So again, if your viewpoint is from a 3 to 5 year plus investment fund frame, I think commodities are an area that are under-owned by most investors and should be owned at this point, looking out. I think personally, given the amount of money that's been printed, the amount of deficits that have been added to, know, the last 2 weeks, Canada's announced, you know, RBC's projection is $250 billion. And, you know, the finance minister announced, $343 billion deficit. And just to put that in context, pro rata vis-a-vis the U.S., that is a 65% higher level of deficit this year for Canada on a pro rata basis than the United States. And, you know, we're not the reserve currency in Canada, right? So I would suspect that, you know, the debt bubble, which has been accumulated over the last 12 years corporately through share buybacks and just debt issuance by governments, by provinces, and quite candidly by households, at some point is going to create a significant dislocation in Canada. So distressed strategies, you know, whether private equity or credit or, you know, different opportunity sets around distressed investments. I think for, you know, very sharp investors, I think there's some areas there that you can make some very good money on here going ahead the next 2 to 3 years. So, you know, back to the earlier comment about cash, this is one of those periods of time in which doing nothing or doing less and, you know, tapping into your patience level here over the course of the next, you know, from an investor point of view, over the next 18, 24 months is probably going to be the prudent choice. Because this is, I think there's going to be some significant distress coming in the overall equity and fixed income markets. And in fact, the high yield market right now, you know, which are, you know, higher yielding bonds, corporate bonds in the U.S., you know, they're far less covenant, they're covenant light these days. I think there's a really strong possibility of some significant defaults. You saw that with Hertz. We'll see that. I think there's going to be a wave of defaults for the next 24 months as we kind of, you know, see the economy adjust to this. So it's going to be a challenging period. But John, what do you think?
Oh, you know, I agree with a lot of that. And, you know, I guess a couple of things I would just layer on is that when you mentioned real estate, because I really do believe, as you say, depends on what type of real estate, because often a lot of real estate valuations are based off of the level of interest rates and affordability. So, you know, that it creates challenges in a lot of parts of real estate, but opportunities in some areas where you're, as you mentioned, like data centers. And then further to that, on, you know, leverage. I mean, when you look back, you know, you clearly, you know, Athena, because he's mentioned a few references to, you know, long historical periods. I mean, periods of high leverage can be sort of deflationary forces because, you know, there's not enough discretionary income, whether it's corporate or individual, for the ability to raise prices generally. And so that's an interesting dynamic. And the other thing is, you know, periods of sustained high inflation typically have wage inflation associated with them. Certainly we've not seen that, you know, wages adjusted for inflation have been kind of flat for quite a while now. So to the extent that inflation would actually carry through to wage inflation is what I think would create the real inflationary pressures. And so, you know, they mentioned commodities, gold. I think within equities, you really, it would be fairly segmented. You'd have to look for companies, industries that actually have the ability to sustain and raise prices in what may be a, you know, long, slow economic recovery, as was talked about earlier. We've seen, you know, sort of the stay-at-home beneficiaries having some, you know, some, you know, food retail, food producers, you know, paper products, you know, some obvious candidates in the last while. I think, you know, they're determining who actually has the ability to sustain and raise prices over the next couple of years in a kind of volatile, uncertain, you know, slowly recovering economic environment. That's that could potentially be the inflation hedge. And maybe the last thing I'd just put on is, you know, it's not so much inflation hedge, but I'm looking at the low, absolute low level of interest rates today, record lows essentially here. And in many cases, if you look at, you know, like dividend stocks, which have been disproportionately actually beaten up relative to the market, if you believe, and if you can find companies where you feel they can sustain their dividend through here, that could be an interesting area to be looking at, because you know you have an almost record spread between yield, you know, dividend yields and low interest rates. If interest rates stay low, and you know, obviously we've seen some companies, certain banks like Wells Fargo in the U.S. have to cut their dividends. But if companies that can sustain their dividends, that could be an interesting area.
But John, just you bring that up, and maybe Canadian banks. I mean, they've been great on the dividends. Nobody's rolled anything back today. They haven't bounced back very much. Are you guys looking at Canadian, what's your perspective on Canadian banks today?
Well, you know, that's a really interesting area. I mean, typically, you know, I guess our view is you look at banks when they're actually, you know, sold off and cheap. You know, Canadian banks are a bit unique, and they tend to trade at a premium on a few valuation metrics. You know, if you look like at things like, you know, price to book or cash flow, they tend to trade at a premium relative to banks in other countries, because we have a, you know, pretty solid, stable foundation here, and it's really oligopolistic territory or oligopolistic market. So they clearly are more interesting. There's obviously some headwinds if you think that, for instance, real estate will not be as, you know, robust or will be flat over the next few years, because it was such a strong backdrop for them over the last decade plus. The valuations are more interesting. You know, they have strong capital structures. You know, they have decent dividend yields. So I think it's an interesting group. They clearly have lagged, though. I mean, you know, I was looking at some data on the Canadian market, and banks have actually a big reason for this. I mean, from the bottom, you know, Thane gave some data earlier, but from the bottom of the Canadian market, you know, the average stock is up 53%. Gold, software in Canada, small industry software are big drivers of that. But, you know, the index itself is only up 38. And the holdback has been the banks. Like, they have been underperformers because of the perception that if this is going to be a more challenging economic recovery, you know, their earnings power is not going to be as good over the next while. But remember, I go back to strong capital bases, you know, oligopolistic structure, you know, decent yields, interesting valuations now.
And I'll, you know, come back to you, because on the Canadian banks, you've had different opinions, but they've taken such large loan provisions right now in the last
11.
So again, does that loan provision, for those that don't, it basically anticipates all the write-offs and the bankruptcies coming. So they've taken the hit today. What's your perspective now on the banks?
Yeah. So, my personal view is the Canadian banks probably go 20 to 40% lower from here over the course of the next 12 to 18 months. So I would be less positive. Part of the reason for that is, you know, just to give you some comparables, 20% of Canadian mortgages today held on the bank's balance sheets are in deferred mode. Compare that to the U.S. is roughly 8%. So, you know, this COVID, you know, and all the government programs is we're kind of in this wait and see mode because of that, and the program in Canada has been extended to the end of the year. So I still believe there's another shoe to drop. There has been roughly $11 billion in provisions, loan loss provisions set aside by the Canadian banks, most recently in the latest quarter. The, you know, if I look back to 2007 to 2010, during that period of time, Canadian banks on average went down almost 60% from peak to low, and then, you know, obviously rallied off the low point. This scenario to me seems way worse, and yet the Canadian banks during this period of time dropped only 44% from peak to low, and have rallied roughly 33%. So as John mentioned, has rallied, but not as, you know, as much as other sectors. So Canadian banks, in my opinion, have some more pain to come. I don't think the provisions taken most recently are going to be it. I think there's going to be more from what I'm hearing from different sources. So, you know, Canadians love their Canadian banks. And, you know, I've made a lot of money in Canadian banks over time. But I would say, you know, I still think there's some more pain to come there. A couple other points just maybe to add, because, you know, Leon, you asked earlier about private equity. So private equity and venture capital, I didn't really touch too much upon. Those areas the vintages of private equities, private equity funds, or venture capital funds today, raising money for the, really good operators that can raise capital today and put the money to work over the course of the next 2 years. I think today's vintages are going to be extremely good in performance because, again, I think they're going to be able to buy or sift through and see some really good opportunities in repricing and lower pricing on a lot of different things. And that's indicatively what we're hearing across the board. And then secondly, I guess the other comment, the analog I would point to is what can happen, and I'm not suggesting it's going to happen in North America, but is Japan. Japan, got super over-levered in the late 80s on real estate, and basically their financials got hit the following 2 years in 1991 as the recession kind of took place. And literally their banking system almost collapsed. It was down around 85 to 90% during that period. And they've had this cascading 30-year, in essence, challenging period. So they've had trading rallies and there's been opportunities. But, there's an example of a system that was highly over-leveraged and how debt tends to put a significant cap on potential growth. So, so many of the people on this call today are business owners. So I guess what I would say to you is if you have a business that is still strongly growing in this environment, I would, seriously take a look at monetizing at least some of my business holdings here over the next year or two. The reason why I say that is a lot of private equity is going to be looking for companies that are still growing in an extremely tough market environment like this. So again, there's going to be opportunities in different sectors and whatnot, but that's just some additional things I'd add.
That's great. Thanks, Nate. I know we passed 12 o'clock. I put a note out there that we may extend this for another 5 minutes. If you have to leave, we are recording the session. Thane, come back to asset allocation. You're dealing with a lot of very high net worth, some ultra high net worth families. What's the asset allocation look like for these people right now?
Yeah, so yeah. Higher cash than normal, probably 17 to 22%. Business holdings, they tend to still own, private businesses, probably another 30%. Fixed income, they really don't like bonds here for the most part. And this will be, fairly consistent with the Tiger 21 asset allocation research, that you get. Equities, public market equities, they're 20 to 30%, depends on the industry that they're in. Some higher if there's a concentrated position. And then, on the real estate side, they tend to be, anywhere between 20 and 30%, depends on where they're at. And that's inclusive of their principal residences. So, they tend to be more spread out. And it reminds me of the old phrase, concentration of resources or wealth tends to create wealth, i.e. through a business, i.e. through a concentrated stock position. But keeping it basically requires a lot of diversification to high-quality assets. So today, they're spread out quite well. And for some of our clients, we've actually been adding here this week. Actually, this week, we've been adding some short or long short type strategies to the portfolios to be able to try to make money if and when the markets decline through different shorting or negative scenarios. So we're in our way of advising clients right now, we're probably hard defensive here at this point as we speak here today. So diversification is critical, and again, trying to make sure from a balance sheet point of view, the amount of debt and leverage is more than manageable at this point in the cycle.
I think that was very helpful. Again, one of the reasons I sort of wanted to have you and John on the call today is I am really worried about how our, you know, we spend so much time in our operating businesses. Companies are fantastic at keeping our minds occupied, working 70, 80 hours a week into the business. So we have very little time to think about the wealth that we're actually creating and taking care of that as well. And you spend so much energy building that wealth that we may lose sight of it. And I want to make sure these people actually preserve their capital. So understanding a little bit of that asset allocation is really
important. I would also add one other thing, Leon. You know, you and I have known each other for about a decade now. Most entrepreneurs that I know, they're really passionate about their business. They're not really passionate about the markets. But in fact, I think that they view the markets in some ways as a necessary evil, right? It provides some diversification, some liquidity, but they really don't like it. Or if they do, it's kind of a neutral attitude towards it. What they're really passionate about is the business. And at the end of the day, that's how most wealth creation occurs, is through, you know, an individual business today. So I just want to kind of add that little tidbit.
No, I think that's really important. The other thing, as I conclude the call, I mean, what's really obvious to me in listening both to you and John here is the complexity. In good times, it's almost easy to be an investor. When times are like this and there's so much uncertainty, I almost think you got to be crazy to try and do it alone. Like, you can buy public companies, but when you start talking about all these other alternative investment tips, who's got the time to really think about that? Like, you're at such a disadvantage. So thank you, Thane, for joining us today. John, thank you for your feedback as well.
My pleasure.
Thank you for hosting me on.
Yeah, no, really great session. And thank you all for joining us today as well. And if you're interested in any further The Way Forward live webcast, please visit us at po-leadership.com. You'll find we have a number of recorded webcasts that we've done over the last 4 months that include Professor Janice Stein, one of the founders of the Munk Institute, professor at U of T. We've got Rosabeth Cantor, Professor Michael Beer, both professors at Harvard. Joe Jackman and Stefan Reed of Jackman Reinvents talked with us 2 weeks ago. And Harry Kramer, the former CEO of Baxter International, was on with us a number of weeks ago as well with Year 168. Just phenomenal. We have a big session coming up in a couple of weeks that I am going to do personally. I'm actually getting JP Palluk-Fry, who's probably one of the top leadership experts when it comes to EI, and really talking that the conversations there is going to focus around how a crisis separates great leadership from the rest of the pack. And I think we got a lot of changes coming in the next 6 to 12 months. Anyway, on behalf of us all, thank you, Thane. Thank you, John, for contributing as well. I wish you all a fantastic rest of the day and have a wonderful weekend. That concludes our session for today.
Thanks, everybody.
Bye now.